We're going to call to order our Rules Committee. There is a quorum present, and let the record show that. As people who know who were here last Friday, we had a couple bills we were carried over, and we told them then, and we would like to live up to those expectations, that they will go first today. So with that, and knowing that we have a lot of business, and I would hope people could keep their testimony as short as they possibly can. We love written testimony. We will take that all together. If you notice a pattern from last Wednesday through today and probably into this coming Wednesday, we are taking a look at a lot of initiative reform bills, and out of that we expect will come the things that we want to move forward as time goes on. But we wanted to get as much information as we could about these bills from as many different people. So, again, if you can keep your testimony short and succinct, and as much written testimony as you can to us so we can ponder over those, we would appreciate it. So with that, also, we had had on our announcements before the House Bill 2820 and HCR 28 were going to be on today. We've already accepted. They're going to be on Wednesday because of the timing. And so I wanted to make sure that if anybody had come here specific for those only, those two were going to be put off until we come back on Wednesday. So with that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3033. And I'll have a short explanation from our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, HB 3033 limits the signature gathering period to 2 years for a petition to initiate or refer county or city measures. It requires that a petition to initiate or refer county or city measures be submitted not less than 90 days preceding an election at which the measure is to be voted on. ORS 250.165 with regard to county measures, and ORS 250.165 with regard to city measures currently provide that the chief petitioner provide notice that a petition is still active on or before each anniversary of approval, but does not establish a maximum time within which a petition may be circulated.
So with that, we will invite John Chandler. Looks like John Coleman and Andrea Meyer. Is that John Coleman? That's John Chandler. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, John Chandler for the Oregon Home Builders Association here in support of House Bill 3033. Had the chair gotten to this bill on Friday, my testimony would have consisted of good bill should pass, given the lateness of the hour. I've never actually done that in a hearing. So I'll do slightly more than that, but not much. We have found in many cases around the state something that I did not know prior to doing the research, that they're simply, unless the local governments have an ordinance to the contrary on the books, there is no expiration of local initiatives, and initiatives can be circulated for signature for 3, 4, 5 unlimited periods of time, so long as they check in with the county clerk on an annual basis. All we're trying to do with House Bill 3033 is to put a time limit on local initiative circulations, just similar to what the state timeline is, so that measures actually go to the ballot within some period or time or not of when the idea was derived locally. We think it's a good and important fix. We recommend it to you, and be glad to take any questions.
Well, go ahead.
Chair Robo, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU, here in support of House Bill 3033, something that we identified a number of years ago that really needs to be fixed, that there should be some timelines around how long local ordinances can be carried for petition purposes. 2 years is a very lengthy amount of time, but we want to make sure we're really capturing the thoughts and the ideas and the wishes of the community at a relatively given period of time. 2 years seems to be a good amount of time in which to gather signatures of people who are actually residing there so that they can vote on something while they are still residing there. I would just make sure that I haven't had a chance to double check on this to make sure that we don't have any what we call unintended consequences, that if there are shorter time periods for some local matters, that we don't alter that to 2 years. I think we agree that the purpose is simply that in those cases where there is none, there should be some. Thank you.
Any questions for either of these witnesses? Seeing none, thank you both. And now we have Jan Coleman and Georgette Brown.
table from last Friday.
That's pretty funny.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman, representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Ours is short and sweet. We like the idea very much to limit the initiative petition time period to 2 years. Needless to say, that's something that clerks have to keep tweaking every June to find out if you've got one still in the passage. However, we do believe that this bill has a conflict in it that needs a little review and adjustment. It also speaks to or refer. And I know that the statute it's looking at is a little deceptive because it's talking about petitions for both initiative and referral, but then it goes into this little piece where it actually is the limiting of the initiative. But in the bill, it's got or refer. So we've given you what we think needs to be adjusted and two lines there because it's out of sync with the actual referral time limits that are in different statutes that are being adjusted in this bill.
Thank you very much.
No, I think Jan said it. The referrals to ordinances that are passed by county governments or city governments, they have a different time period. They cannot go on forever. A county one is 90 days. A city one is 60 days. So they should not be. The referral should not be mentioned in this context. It's the initiatives that we're concerned with here.
Thank you. So what you're saying is that every county and city already have limits on the number of days that a referral can be
a
out
referral
there.
But initiatives
have no such limitation.
Right. Correct.
And so in this particular bill, if we took out anything with respect to referrals, it would be fine.
That's right.
Okay. I will talk with some of the people, but I think that's kind of what was mentioned earlier. They just didn't have it the same way. So thank you.
Excuse me. I'm Georgette Brown. I didn't
yes.
say that.
Thank you, Georgette. Any other questions for this, please? Thank you very much. You should also have received some testimony from Sal Peralta for the record, and I think each of you have that. And with that, conclude. Yes.
Not a question, but I would certainly be supportive of the amendment that was just recommended and the bill as amended.
Yeah, and I think it was true the other people didn't want them to make them longer if they were already at a certain place. So I think we're all kind of in agreement. So we'll try to get that drafted and be ready, and we'll take care of that.
Good.
Up here.
Thanks.
Any other questions, concerned? We're going to close our hearing on House Bill 3033, and we will open a public hearing on 2941. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. House Bill 2941 requires the Attorney General to provide identical draft ballot titles for state measures if the Attorney General determines that the subject, purpose, and major effect of two or more state measures are substantially similar. Previously discussed the elimination of the current requirement for non-identical titles when this measure was up for public hearing on Friday. In terms of background, ORS 250.0356 currently provides, quote, to avoid confusion, a ballot title shall not resemble any title previously filed for a measure to be submitted at the election.
Thank you very much. And with that, we will invite Joe Bessler and the Miller, Kathy Eaton up.
Oops.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I will be very brief. For quite some time, the League has been very concerned about the efforts of, the wasted almost efforts of resources and time in dealing with 4, 5, 6 initiative petitions that are essentially the same subject. We believe that House Bill 2941 addresses that issue, and we support it.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, for the record, Andy Miller, Senior Policy Analyst, Oregon Business Association. Oregon Business Association advocates for enhancement of Oregon's business environment and quality of life, providing bipartisan statewide leadership that strives to ensure Oregon's long-term prosperity. OBA has been working with City Club of Portland and other stakeholders since early in 2008 to identify problems we felt were diminishing the integrity of the initiative system. As our circle widened, we formalized a coalition to analyze and discuss various options for reform. As the session progressed, we became aware of other proposals and proponents whose bills became part of our discussion. House Bill 2941 is one of those bills. Our work with the City Club of Portland included a discussion of the process of assigning ballot titles. We agreed with their recommendation that the Oregon Attorney General should assign the same ballot titles to substantively identical proposed measures. Aware that the exact wording of ballot titles is a major factor affecting the success of ballot measure campaigns, petitioners often submit multiple variations of their initiatives with minor differences in wording and shop for the ballot title most attractive to voters. Ballot title shopping has become central to many campaign strategies and comes at a significant cost to Oregon taxpayers. Specifically, ballot title shopping increases administrative burdens and costs for Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the Supreme Court. Current statute provides that the Attorney General may not assign identical ballot titles to multiple proposed measures. This bill directs the Attorney General to provide identical draft ballot titles for state measures if the AG determines that the subject, purpose, and major effect of two or more measures are substantively similar. This bill will save significant state resources by curtailing the costly practice of ballot title shopping. OBA supports the consideration of the concepts contained in House Bill 2941 as part of a comprehensive plan to restore integrity to the initiative process. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. I just had a couple of things to add. Everything's been said quite well. I would say that the system we have now uses public resources to supplement the polling of private folks putting things on the ballot by allowing them multiple options for when they do their polls. And it doesn't do anything to inform the voter or make it a better process or more information. It just sort of allows them to have a couple of different options when they test these things. And also, we want to say we have a lot of faith in the Attorney General and their ability to determine what is substantially similar, and they do a great job. Thank you.
Any questions for these witnesses? My only question has to do with the IRMA that we did last session and the raising of the limit to 1,000 voters to get it tested. Has that had a substantial, from your opinion, reduction in the level of ballot shopping?
You know, I'm not sure. I think we haven't been through a whole cycle yet, so we don't know the full effects. I think it was only those measures that were recently filed this year that apply, that 1,000 signatures apply to. Mm-hmm.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, those folks that place multiple measures on the ballot or put the petitions in have access to a lot of resources often, and the 1,000-vote thousand signature limit won't necessarily impede them.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Andrea Meyer and Dan Meek.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2941, but I do want to offer an amendment in concept. I have talked to the chief sponsor, Representative Garrett, about this, and he is not opposed to this. And that is we write language that says the AG may but is not required to do the identical ballot title in a separate initiative election process. As you know, the process is every 2 years, and it's a cycle, and same concepts get reintroduced, and there may be a change in the meaning or what's going on, and I just would prefer that we keep the flexibility to the Attorney General after 2 years to reconsider or tweak it slightly. So having talked to the sponsor and who supports that, I would say, having just spent about three weekends ago, spending my time filing ballot title comments on three initiatives filed in this cycle with over 1,000 signatures, literally having to hold them up, read them line by line to find the one or two language word differences that would that results in a one or two language word difference in the ballot title, it will be quite easy for the AG to find the identical ones. You know, while that is all good and well that the AG basically now fortunately issues a ballot title that has very little changes from the other one because of the word game going on, it does cost everyone time and resources. We have to file comments in all three. That's fine. We're not government resources, and that's our job. However, the Attorney General has to issue three ballot titles. The Attorney General has to evaluate all the comments, and if we challenge them before the court, we have to challenge all three in this case. And so it is become, for lack of a better word, a game, and the changes in the initiative language are so minuscule as to make it meaningless, but for ballot title shopping purposes. So we would encourage you to move forward, but would consider an amendment just to, again, it would give the AG the opportunity, but the AG could issue the same ballot title if he or she wanted for a different election cycle.
Thank you. And Dan.
Dan Meek, I oppose this bill. To begin with, it's not necessary. I do have written testimony, by the way, which I'm presently unable to find the 40 copies that I brought. But first, it's completely unnecessary. House Bill 2082 from the last session, of course, changed the threshold from 25 signatures for qualifying a prospective petition to 1,000 signatures. The result of that is that since that bill went into effect on January 1st, 2008, there have been a grand total of 14 prospective petitions filed on statewide measures. During exactly the same period in the previous two-year election cycle, the number of prospective petitions filed was 97. So we have an 85% reduction in the number of prospective petitions because of House Bill 2082. In addition, of the few measures that have been filed, many of those already are somewhat similar. There's five or six that are rather similar about marijuana, and five or six on some other topic. And I think that this bill is premised upon a false assumption that the Attorney General does provide any kind of significantly different ballot titles when it comes to these, you know, similar measures. In fact, he doesn't. As Andrea Meyer just mentioned, a one or two word difference in the wording of the proposed measure results in a one or two word difference in the ballot title. Now, I don't think it's I don't think it is unreasonable to expect proponents of a petition or an idea or a concept or something that they want the people to vote on should be allowed to try different language. This legislative body knows exactly how important a ballot title is. In 2007, this body itself referred seven measures to voters and insisted upon writing the ballot title for all seven of them and precluding all judicial review of those ballot titles. It was the first time that I know of the legislature has ever done that, except in a case when the election was coming up right immediately, like in the spring of the year in which the legislature was in session. The legislature not only wrote all seven of the ballot titles, that is, the caption, the yes and no questions, and the summary, the legislature also wrote the complete explanatory statement, bypassing the explanatory statement process, wrote the complete fiscal impact statement, bypassing the fiscal impact statement process, wrote everything and precluded any judicial review of any of that language to appear on the ballot and in the voter's pamphlet. The result was predictable. Of those seven measures, six of them were enacted, quite overwhelmingly most of them, and the only one that was not passed as a result of an expenditure of, I think, around $15 million by the tobacco companies to defeat the tobacco tax. That was the only one that wasn't passed. So, yes, ballot titles are extremely important, and if proponents are not allowed to propose different kinds of language in a measure, then I think that is a huge impediment to the initiative process, and it's such an and this legislature has recognized that. If this legislature didn't recognize the crucial importance of ballot titles, then it wouldn't have written its own ballot titles for the last seven measures that it referred to voters. It would have gone through the same process of allowing the Attorney General, the normal process in statute, that the Attorney General drafts the ballot title subject to public comment. The Attorney General certifies the ballot title, and anyone who commented can then appeal to the courts. The real problem with the ballot title process is that there is no deadline for the court for review. Folks can submit submit their prospective petitions, and the court can take any amount of time that it wishes to review the titles. Oftentimes, in recent years, in some years, the court has taken over a year to review a ballot title. In recent years, the court has taken as long as 7 months, 7 or 8 months to review ballot titles, as a result, eating up most of the time that's available for the collection of signatures and, in effect, keeping potential measures off the ballot. Finally, when somewhat similar measures or very similar measures are filed, I know for a fact that the ballot titles are essentially identical anyway. So the statute that this bill repeals is not being observed in any event. And I think that that particular statute that says that no ballot title assigned by the Attorney General will be similar to one that's already been assigned might as well be repealed because it's not observed anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these witnesses? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who wishes to speak to House Bill 2941? Because that was the end of those who signed up. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on 2941. Give you that. And we're going to open a public hearing on HJR 17. With that, we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Joint Resolution 17 proposes a constitutional amendment to require the submission of state initiative petitions to the Legislative Assembly. It requires initiative petitions to be filed with the Secretary of State not less than 45 days before the beginning of a regular session of the Legislative Assembly. Directs the Secretary of State to submit an initiative petition containing the required number of valid signatures to the Legislative Assembly. Allows the Legislative Assembly to, or requires the Legislative Assembly to consider the petition without change or amendment prior to the end of the regular session. It allows the Legislative Assembly to conduct an advisory vote, refer, reject, or take no action on the proposal, or to refer an alternative proposal to the people. It allows the petitioner to withdraw initiative petitions from the ballot and directs the Secretary of State to place a proposed initiative on the ballot and specifies voting procedures if the proposed initiative and alternative measure referred, if a proposed initiative and alternative measure referred by the Legislative Assembly appear on the ballot in the same election. An indirect initiative process is currently used in 8 states. In the indirect initiative process, a proposed initiative is referred to the legislature after proponents have gathered the required number of signatures. The legislature then has the option to enact, defeat, or amend the measure. Depending on the legislature's action, the proponents may continue to seek to pursue placement on the ballot for a popular vote. In several states, Massachusetts, Ohio, and Utah, proponents must gather additional signatures to place the measure on the ballot. In others, it goes automatically to the ballot. Proponents of the indirect initiative assert that the indirect initiative is an improvement over a direct initiative because it allows for legislative analysis, deliberation, and debate that may result in an improved initiative proposal. Opponents assert that in those states where the process is currently used, legislatures rarely take up the initiative proposal, and when they do, they almost always reject initiative proposals. Opponents further assert that the indirect initiative lengthens and delays the initiative process without offsetting benefits.
Thank you. And with that, we'll have Senator Frank Morris and Representative Larry Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm honored to be before you today with my good colleague on my right.
Not very often on your right, Senator.
But sometimes. For the record, Frank Morse, representing District 8, Lynn and Benton counties, portions thereof. Thank you for bringing this bill back for consideration again. And I would preface my remarks by recalling a conversation, and I believe it was actually in public testimony, but it was an interim meeting, and it was with a sponsor of a major piece of legislation that had a large fiscal impact. And the question was posed, how will you pay for this? And the response was, well, we've managed it in the past, and I'm paraphrasing, we've managed it in the past, and the economy will take care of it, and the revenue will grow to provide resources to pay for it. Well, let me back up, if I may, and share with you how revenue has grown and how it has paid for initiatives in the past. If you go back to the biennium 89-91 and move forward to the end of the 07 biennium, what we have found, and these are legislative revenue figures, is what we have found is that of the growth in discretionary spending in the state budget of $7 billion, $3.4 billion was directly attributed to what the voters have enacted by virtue of the initiative process. Further, if you look at an adjustment of spending on a per capita basis, again, legislative revenue numbers, inflation adjusted and initiative impact adjusted, what you find is that we moved from a spending per capita of $1,625 in the 89-91 biennium to $1,583 in the 2005-07 biennium. We were spending actually less, contrary to the public belief, that we are wild, profligate spenders. Further, if you look at the impact on K through 12 spending, if you look at the period of time at which K through 12, Measure 5, was normalized and bring that forward, what you find is on an inflation-adjusted basis and student growth increase, you find funding for students in the 92-93 period of $6,176, and move forward to 2005 and 2006 school year, that number dropped to $5,512. And if you look at that number as it then plays out in higher education as well, you wind up also with a 36% in real dollars decline in funding for a higher education. So the impact that initiatives have on our resources has been significant. And to create a more rational process to evaluate these impacts, to shine a very bright light on the intended and unintended consequences, and to evaluate how we are going to pay for these issues, and to bring that through the HJR 17 model, I believe will serve Oregon's interests well. The issue that is raised most frequently in opposition to this concept is in the concept of biennial sessions. You find that the process is lengthened. If we are in annual sessions, that issue is certainly mitigated. But I would suggest to you that when we're dealing with matters as grave as funding for the critical services that initiatives bring, I mean, they bring an impact on those funding issues, to be more thoughtful, to be more circumspect, to bring it before this body and have the open process of debate, evaluation, and advisory votes is a worthy endeavor. Not to deny access, to the initiative process, but to make the process more thoughtful and informed. And that's the purpose of HGR 17. The amendment, one of the critical amendments that my colleague will address is the provision that allows the petitioner to withdraw the initiative if the legislature is found to be responsive. So with that, Mr. Chairman, colleagues, I thank you for this opportunity to share with you today.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Larry Glazio, House District 35, and appreciate Senator Morris being here. And the hope is that this isn't mere symbolism, that this is a bipartisan and I hope bicameral process. And I just wanted to start off by assuring anyone that's listening, despite what you might read in some places or might even hear today, this is will not end the initiative system. This is a let's mend it, not end it. I sincerely believe that this would serve to restore the integrity to the initiative process and make it better. And what I'd like to do briefly is try to describe how the process would work and then talk a little bit about why I support it. And then I would like to address some of the concerns that I've heard. Senator Morris and myself had had an opportunity to have some vigorous discussions with some who have differing opinions and some who agree. So first, in terms of how this would work, number one is the qualification element to get the required number of signatures would remain the same. Statutory initiatives, 6%, constitutional, 8%. So that would be the same. Everything up to, requiring would be the same. So once a ballot measure has qualified, or a petition has qualified for the ballot, it would come to the legislature on the first day of the legislative session. The presiding officers would then refer the bills to the relevant committees. So if it were a land use related initiative, it would most likely go to a land use committee. Then the committee would have a minimum of one hearing, at least one hearing, where you would have the opportunity to begin in earnest that deliberative discussion. And as you know, in hearings, such as what we're conducting here, there's an opportunity to ask the difficult questions, to talk about constitutionality, and to raise issues. Then there are three options after that. So the committee hears it, and there are essentially three options. One option is if the committee hears something that they like and can work with the chief petitioner, and the chief petitioner or chief petitioners are willing, and you find groups in the legislature that like the initiative who want to create a bill and enact it, they can do that. So this would actually expedite the process for the chief petitioner. In other words, if the bill is something that we want to enact, we can enact it that session. So in that level, it's positive. So that's one. And of course, as the amendment says, the chief petitioner can then withdraw it from the ballot. So that's one option. Second option is if the legislature sees it as something that is not favorable, or at least the committee sees it as not favorable, could do an advisory vote, and that information would go to the voters' pamphlet, and no compromise is reached, it would just go to the ballot. So it would go to the ballot, and there would be an advisory vote that would, and this element of the advisory vote is something that I think we're open to how we want to do this, whether it's just a committee that's going to take an advisory vote, but that information would then be given to the voters. In other words, ballot measure 32, Legislative Committee on Land Use voted 4-3 in favor of it or in support of it, thought it was a good thing, or vice versa. Third option is similar to what happened with measure 61, the public safety measure that qualified and then the legislative referral measure 57, although with an important difference, and I want to make sure, I hope I can describe this accurately. And I'd rather use a different example instead of measure 57 and 61. Let's say that somebody comes with a petition and they get the requisite number of signatures and it's to change the Made in Oregon sign to how do I get to Cesar Chavez Boulevard? Okay, so that's their petition. And they get the requisite number of signatures to change the wording on the sign. Qualifies. Comes to the legislature on the first day of session. The presiding officers in both the House and the Senate would then send it to the relevant committees. I don't know what the relevant committees would be on that. But so that would go, and then there would be hearings. And you would have an opportunity for the chief petitioners or chief petitioner to articulate their case, back and forth, deliberative discussion. If the legislature and the chief petitioners couldn't come with a compromise, the legislature could seek to do an alternative. So if the legislature thought, well, we do want to deal with the Made in Oregon sign, so we're going to have an alternative sign that would say, I can't remember what my alternative was. Oh, keep Portland weird. So the legislature wants to have the keep Portland weird alternative. Both of those would go to the ballot, as did 57 and 61. So voters would have an option of supporting the referral, keep Portland weird, or how do you get to Cesar Chavez Boulevard? But if you're like me, you probably had a little bit of frustration with the 57 and 61. There were a lot of people who didn't like either of those bills. However, they felt as if they needed to vote perhaps for 57 because they were concerned that if 61 passed and 57 didn't. So what this measure would do is you would actually have two votes in a sense. First, you could vote. You would have both of them lined up, and you could vote no on both. If you didn't like either of the Keep Portland Weird or How Do You Get to Cesar Chavez Boulevard, you could just vote no. Then secondarily, it would be, however, in the case that they pass, if you would like to indicate a preference, you may. And there you would choose one or the other as the preferable alternative should both of them pass. So you wouldn't be in the situation where you're having to vote only for the lesser of two evils. You would first vote yes or no, and then in the case that both of them did pass, then you would be choosing the lesser of two evils, but you would at least have that opportunity to vote no on both. So just briefly, in addition to the deliberative discussion that I think is absolutely critical, which will hopefully inform voters a lot more, in the status quo, political consultants and multi-million dollar campaigns are very effective at simplifying the message and often using emotive means to convince people of what the initiatives mean or don't mean, and that's problematic. That wouldn't end, but I believe that a more deliberative discussion in committee would probably get publicity and would be helpful. Secondly, I think the idea behind this is there's greater accountability for the chief petitioner. If you have to come before a body or a committee such as this and answer difficult questions and you're on tape, I think that's important. For both sides, I think it also gives the legislature more accountability because we're going to have to face some of these issues head on, face to face. And I think that's good for the public and I think it's important for us. Just to deal with some of the major arguments against. The major argument that I've heard against this is, well, it's going to delay things for too long of a period of time. I like this quotation from Cicero who said, it's better that a good measure should fail than a bad one should pass. This body and this state have seen many, many problematic measures, whether you're on the left of the spectrum or the right of the spectrum. Some people don't like minimum wage. Some people don't like Measure 47. Not that those would the decisions would have been different, but I think a more deliberative process, which maybe causes some delay, but that's important. What we're doing here is that significant. I don't want to go too much into the arguments against, but there were some handouts that you may or may not have gotten. There are 9 other states currently that have an indirect initiative process.
One of the things that we will notice is
in the United States in the last sort of 30 years, you haven't seen any states that don't have the initiative going toward the initiative and implementing it. And the reason that's so is because it hurts the bond rating and it causes a lot of uncertainty and difficulty. So this HGR 17, I think, will mend it, not end it, will be an improvement to the system, more deliberative democracy, and greater accountability. Appreciate your the time.
Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses?
Yeah.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, gentlemen. What do you say to those who say that most of the initiatives come, in a sense, from a failure of the legislative process or a perceived failure of the legislative process, and that's why it goes to direct initiative? In other words, I would tell you that outside of this building and maybe this room, just because the legislature deliberated on it doesn't necessarily impress the voters that that's a good thing. You get what I'm getting at.
No, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Berger. My conviction is that the initiative process diminishes the legislative process. And what I mean by that is I believe that it has substituted for the hard work that if you had, in fact, let's just assume that you had no initiative process. You would have a longer way to address these unmet needs by virtue of turnover of members in this body. And as we know, that does happen. The pendulum swings back and forth. It would be a longer process, but I think eventually you would come closer to where the public, you know, would go and a majority vote on an initiative. But that's not the case, and I'm not proposing that we ban the initiative process. But, you know, the point you raise is a very valid one. I think we earn our stripes in many cases. To the extent that we work more closely together in a bipartisan way to solve these problems and listen, we can regain that trust. To the extent that we continue to divide this body on partisan lines, we diminish that in the eyes of the voter, and we build the distrust. So I think we can earn our way out of this issue, but it takes time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that as well? Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'd say, number one, that threat, that so-called gun behind the door, would remain with the indirect initiative. In other words, it would still be there. This bill would not take that away. Secondly, the originators of the initiative, and there was a lot of different groups. I love the fact when we argue it today, it's all based on the evil, tyrannical legislature, and we do some really dumb things. There is no doubt about that. There's nobody sitting here that doesn't completely disagree with some of the bills that have gone through or voted against or said, how could we have done that? I don't think there's anybody here. So that doesn't change. But the industrialization of the initiative process, the creation of a business, it was never meant to be something like that. It's been colonized by out-of-state interests. So the notion that there's this pure initiative process versus the tyrannical legislature is really a false choice. But really, the reality is the threat would remain. In fact, it would force us to deal with it. I think it would put it in our laps and make the committee have hearings where we don't have to do that all the time. So the threat would remain with this bill.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Further questions? Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think we're just going to go down our list. And so the next would be Alice Bartlett, David Cannon, and Kathy Eaton.
Thank you. Members of the committee, I'm Alice Bartelt, and I'm the public policy co-chair for the American Association of University Women of Oregon, and I speak in support of this bill. I don't want to read my testimony to you, but I just wanted to emphasize the fact that the initiative would still show up on the ballot regardless of what the legislature does unless they implement it. So it's not taking away the opportunity for voters to vote on it.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, and Vice Chairs and members of the House Rules Committee. My name is David Cannon. I'm from Portland, and I really appreciate this opportunity to represent the City Club of Portland and its Volunteer Citizens Committee that spent over 2 years studying the Oregon Initiative and Referendum System. I've passed out written testimony, but since many of the points have been covered, I'll, of course, abbreviate that in my remarks. The many thoughtful and constructive proposals designed to strengthen the Oregon Citizens Initiative that are being heard in this and other committees of the 2009 legislature are really evidence that times have changed. The City Club, when we began our committee process about 3 years ago, the first people we invited to talk to us were members of a similar committee that had tackled the subject 10 years earlier. They were not very optimistic about our chances of even getting a hearing on any recommendations. And so we really feel that the time has changed and there's a much greater emerging consensus in the wider community that changes are needed. We saw a strong endorsement in yesterday's Oregonian newspaper, for example, for several of the measures now before you, including the indirect initiative. And this was only the latest of many such endorsements, not only from leading newspapers, but from other segments of the community. And I'm sure you'll hear from some of them at these hearings. The City Club recommended adoption of the so-called indirect initiative system with the very features that you find in HJR 17. This and our other recommendations were endorsed in January 2008 by a nearly unanimous vote of the club's membership. Let me briefly describe the process of arriving at our conclusions and recommendations and then summarize our reasons for advocating this change. Volunteer study committees at the City Club are comprised of members, and these volunteers are carefully screened to avoid conflicts of interest. The committees gather expert testimony, makes studies of the literature, and other activities in order to produce our reports. Many of you have probably read the report that resulted in 2008. Now, these committees, and ours was a good example, are given a very sufficient timeline to allow us to hear many points of view. The list of people we heard is in the back of the report, and you'll see it takes up at least a full page of small print. So we did take the time to hear a lot of people. When we thought we were through, we considered who we hadn't heard from. We hadn't heard from enough people in Eastern Oregon, so we went out there and interviewed county judges and other personnel who were very concerned about the initiative process. So I think it was a very thorough report. The result is this report, and it was initially mailed to our over 1,400 members of the Portland City Club. Finally, following a public meeting on the report, City Club members determined by a vote whether the study committee's conclusions and recommendations should become official policy positions of the club. And as I noted, it was a virtually unanimous vote. I think one person abstained. Of the 9 recommendations contained in our report, none occupied more time in our deliberations and analysis, nor was considered more important than the one represented by HJR 17. Let me summarize then why we feel this measure deserves your support and a chance to be considered by the voters. This measure preserves the tradition that permits Oregonians to draft a proposed law or constitutional amendment and, gaining sufficient signatures, bring that very proposal to the ballot for ratification or rejection by the voters. As the senator and representative sponsoring it said, nothing will alter that fundamental fact. To any people afraid that their initiative rights would be diminished by this bill, I'd say not so. Your proposals might, in some instances, take longer to enact than is the case today. But if you remain determined to see your exact proposition on the ballot and it qualifies, it will be on the ballot. And I think that's important to keep in mind and bears repeating in light of some of the charges that have been brought against this measure. Now, a legislative response to citizens' initiatives, something that we've observed as recently as you know, as in 2007 and again in 2008, is obviously not new with this bill. What HJR 17 would add to the Oregon Constitution's initiative mechanism is that all initiatives, not just some, would have a chance for your response before going to the ballot. Why is this such a worthwhile idea? We think that HJR 17 is an effective response to some of the key conclusions that our study committee reached after hearing from that large and diverse group of Oregonians who represented all sorts of different experience with the initiative and referendums and referral system. Among these conclusions, and I'll summarize them, are use of the so-called indirect initiative system in other states creates the opportunity for more careful and informed deliberation, analysis, and clarification of proposed initiatives. I think this is especially important, as Senator Morse said, for initiatives that have a material effect on state finances, either by reducing income or mandating expenditures. We believe that a simple yes versus no contest carried on primarily in the mass advertising media is not a good means for the state to determine major social or fiscal policy. So the process required by this measure will itself produce a good deal of new grist for the mill of public opinion that we think will add to the quality of discourse preceding a vote. Furthermore, the legislature will have the opportunity to take one of several courses of action that now you are able to exercise only on a more occasional basis. I wanted to mention one more issue here, that poorly drafted initiative measures have produced unintended consequences, such as higher than anticipated costs to taxpayers, as well as litigation to resolve ambiguities, inconsistencies, and overlooked contingent circumstances. That was one of the first conclusions that our committee made after hearing from all sorts of different people. You can probably each think of your own worst examples at this point, and I would simply refer to two episodes that were often noted in testimony to our committee. Measure 5 of 1990 and the subsequent measures 47 and 50, all dealing with property tax limitation and their many consequences. And then measures 7, 37, and 49 to require compensation to property owners. In these cases, there were years of uncertainty, frequent changes, and major direct and indirect costs that were borne by our schools, our local governments, people engaged in economic development and real estate development, and a fair number of ordinary homeowners and taxpayers as a result of all that uncertainty, change, and litigation. Many who might agree with the basic policy thrust of those initiatives bemoaned the results of the specific enactments that were drafted by the petitioners. While these issues may be cited by some as of examples of where the initiative was a necessary recourse when the legislature had supposedly failed to act in response to popular will, we would argue that had we then had an indirect initiative system like HGR 17, the initiative recourse would have still served that purpose, as Representative Galizio recently pointed out. Yet the product of the ensuing legislative process would have reflected the input of diverse stakeholder groups and their expert advocates, and thus would probably have resulted in fewer surprises, less litigation, and much less uncertainty and cost. And I'm not suggesting that the legislature's first attempt to deal with complex issues is always perfect or final, but that it's a process much better suited to arriving at workable solutions more quickly than our current system, which often results in the codification of whatever first appears on a petition circulated by an army of people paid to solicit signatures. I won't go through the options that the legislature is given under this bill, but simply point out that with very little change, they exist right now, as several of us have noted. It's important to remember that if the legislature takes any action, really, the chief petitioner retains the option to send his measure on to the voters as originally intended, or to withdraw it because he's satisfied, he or she is satisfied with the legislature's enactment. And we witnessed just such a scenario a couple of years ago in regard to payday loans, I believe. You've heard about the examples of Measure 57 and 61. I would just emphasize not only that type of situation or the hypothetical white stag sign, but really that there are going to be cases, if we judge from the past, where it's really more of a fix-up variety alternative measure. Not necessarily something competing, but really just a better version that will result in so much less cost and uncertainty. There are many other aspects of our initiative and referendum system that can be approved by bills that have been introduced this year. We find that HJR 17 is not inconsistent with any of them as far as we've seen. So we hope that as you put together a package, as you indicated, Mr. Chairman, that you will find it possible to include this important change in your approach to initiative reform. In our estimation, this bill will do as much to or more to affect the ultimate quality of our state laws and constitution, as well as the financial stability of state and local government, than any of these proposals, as much or more as any of them, without in any way diminishing the public's right to initiate. I urge you to do your utmost to send it to the full House and on to the voters, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Cappy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Cappy Eaton, Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. For more than 20 years, the members of the League have supported the concept of a comprehensive review of proposed and qualified petition initiatives prior to a vote on such proposals. In our position on initiatives adopted in 1987, the League supports the use of the indirect initiative process as a means to thoroughly examine initiative measures so that voters can be aware of the effects and consequences of such laws or constitutional amendments. And we actually participated in the earlier City of Portland study as well as the one that has just been recently completed. Voter education about ballot measures is a primary concern to the League. Citizens need to understand what laws are designed to do, whether they be initiatives or bills by the legislature. Because HJR 17 would require a review by the legislature, there is the assumption there would be public hearings and public discussion about all initiative proposals. And the bill provides several means for dealing with the initiative measure, referring it to the public vote without comment, conducting an advisory vote, referring an alternative, or rejecting it and taking no action. The League supports HJR 17 as a necessary constitutional amendment to improve the initiative process and to provide for public discussion of changes in Oregon law. Recommendations for the indirect process came during the Public Commission on the Legislature and the Task Force on Revenue Restructuring recommendations to this legislature. The time is now to make this important change in the process and restore the public's confidence in its ability to participate in government. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Please. Thank you all. Wayne Brady, Andy Miller, and Ryan Deckert.
My name is Wayne Brady. I'm a resident of Salem. Thank you for letting me testify. I represent Chairman Roblin and members of the committee. I feel that this bill places an undue burden on the initiative process. In the first place, the reason for the initiative is to give the voters a chance to accomplish something the legislature will not accomplish. If the legislature has to approve the initiative, or the voters to get what they want. In the second place, this approval process delays the vote for up to 2 years. sometimes timing is really important, and a delay of 2 years would be disastrous. One of the previous persons testifying talked about unintended consequences, and they mentioned Measure 5 and Measure 7. I think that the consequences were what the sponsors intended. And Measure 11, of course, even after it got passed, there were numerous attempts to water it down. So I just think that the initiative process, the way it is, works well and doesn't need tinkering. Any questions?
Any questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Yeah, Wayne, thank you for your testimony, and thanks for coming to talk on this. The actual bill calls for this to go to the voters for their consideration, which is sort of puts you in an interesting spot. The initiative sort of process, I think, belongs to the citizens of Oregon. I think they hold it dear. And I guess the question is, this is a major change to it. Is it worth asking the voters if they want such a change?
Oh, so this, okay, I understand.
Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah.
And I guess I'd kind of like your thoughts on that. Do you think this is something we should ask the voters? I mean, you're opposed to this particular system, but is it something we should ask the voters if they want to?
I think as long as it's made clear what the bill does, I think that's... So there have been measures put on the ballot recently that I think have been misleading. So I just want to make sure the description is clear.
Ryan.
Mr. Chair, Ryan Deckert, Oregon Business Association. We are a statewide business organization whose membership ranges from the largest farm in the state, which is a beautiful farm in Boardman, Oregon, in House District 57, and I'm trying but not getting there, to Oregon's two Fortune 500 companies. Mr. Chair, this falls in the category of everything's been said, but not everyone has said it, so I will fall back on my personal policy of never disagreeing with Cappy Eaton, who is here, and hope you might do the same. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Ryan. Dan Meek and Richard, is it Bottier?
Bottier.
I knew I couldn't get the... Dan, yeah.
Is there a problem with this microphone? Probably don't need to be as close to it as usual. My name is Dan Meek. I represent, as an attorney, a variety of public interest groups that have used the initiative process since 1978. I'm testifying against both of these joint resolutions, House Joint Resolution 17 and the similar Senate Joint Resolution 11. Both of them merely impose a delay between the submission of sufficient signatures and the opportunity for voters to vote on a measure. The House Joint Resolution imposes a 23-month delay from the current system. In the current system, you file your signatures, and then you get to be on the ballot 4 months later. Under this system, you get to be on the ballot 23 months later, so I guess it's only a 19-month delay. This is different than the indirect initiative processes that are operating in other states. In other states, they do have a process where initiative proponents can submit a small number of signatures to start the process, and then the legislature has some deliberations, and during those deliberations, the initiative proponents, the chief petitioners, are allowed to amend their petition to make it be better, for example. That's not allowed by either of these joint resolutions, which say that you have to go out and collect all of your signatures, which in itself takes a year to 2 years, and then you're locked into what you have proposed, regardless of what is the outcome of the legislative deliberations. So other states have a somewhat collaborative process, but that's not what's being proposed by these. It also, by the way, totally abolishes the initiative process for the year 2012. If you look at either one of these bills, you'll see that in Senate, in House Joint Resolution 17, the deadline for submitting all of your signatures for any measure that would appear in 2012 would be about November 15th, 2010. It'd be about a week after this measure passes if it passes the voters. So essentially, and the other one, the Senate Joint Resolution imposes even a 6-month longer delay. It imposes a 28-month period between the time you submit your signatures and the time you get a vote. And so it would abolish the initiative process entirely for the year 2012. You have to skip an entire biennium there. Because it takes a year to 2 years to get the signatures on a ballot measure anyway, you're basically saying that when folks have an idea that they wish to pursue that the legislature will not enact, like limits on political contributions in my case, you need to basically figure on a 4-year process, a year to 2 years to collect the signatures, and then wait for 2 years in order to allow the voters to vote on this. Now, if this is such a good idea, I think we ought to apply it to the legislative process itself and require a minimum of a 36-month delay after the introduction of every bill in the legislature. If additional deliberation is desirable, then the legislature should also have 3 years of deliberation, just like folks would have under either of these joint resolutions. And, by the way, during that 36-month period, we should ban all amendments to the bill, because that's what these resolutions do to ballot measures. They require the wait, but they don't allow the amendment. You know, there are potentially reasonable reforms out there. For example, if the legislature wants to examine a measure that is on the street, it could do so in the regular session or in the now pretty much assumed annual special sessions or biennial special sessions. The legislature could adopt the measure. The legislature could refer an alternative measure to voters. But, of course, the legislature can already do that. It did that with Measure 57 and 61 in the last cycle. It didn't require this constitutional amendment to do that. Seven of the eight ballot measures that were on initiatives that were on the ballot in 2008 were already on the streets and well toward the qualification process. Well, they actually had qualified for the ballot before the 2008 special session began. So the legislature could have looked at all of those bills and undertaken this process in 2008, but didn't. Seven of the eight were already on the streets and well toward qualification even before the beginning of the 2007 legislative session, because it does take a long time to collect signatures unless you want to build a casino and have a couple million dollars to spend. So the legislature can already look at these things under the current system and can suggest a different measure and place a different measure on the ballot, just like it did with Measure 57. In partial response to Representative Berger's questions about, well, shouldn't we let the people decide this? These are up for all joint resolutions. I would say, yes, let's let people decide that, but in a process that provides them with some objective information about what these measures do. In other words, I would ask the legislature not to write its own ballot title for these joint resolutions, but use the normal process of having a nominally objective third party, the Attorney General, write the ballot titles. As long as the legislature can write the ballot titles for its own joint resolutions, it can essentially guarantee passage, unless it runs up against an opponent like the tobacco companies that has $10 or $20 million available to persuade the voters. Just a couple of other comments. You'll note that many of the objections to the current initiative process expressed today were centrally concerned with the effect of the initiative process on the budget and on spending. But note that these joint resolutions are not limited to initiatives that have any effect whatsoever on the budget or spending. They apply to all resolutions, even if they have utterly no effect on the budget or spending. And, of course, yes, some people don't like the outcome of ballot measures, of initiatives. For example, some folks even today might object to the outcome of the initiative in the year 1912 that granted Oregon women the right to vote 8 years before they had the right under the federal Constitution. I would argue that had no fiscal impact. Nevertheless, these resolutions would have required that we sit on it for a period of 2 to 3 years before allowing voters the opportunity to vote on it after all of the effort had been gone to collect the signatures on a current issue. I mean, issues are current, and if you just say stop for 2 years after you collect the signatures, that is not, as one person said it, that's not mending the initiative process. I believe the phrase was mend it, don't end it. I would say under these resolutions, the proper theme is destroy it, don't enjoy it. Also, Representative Galicio mentioned that more states are not adopting the initiative process. Well, that's because it requires the legislature to put measures on the ballot in order to amend state constitutions to create the initiative process. This merely further demonstrates the inherent conflict that we've mentioned before between the legislature on the one hand and the people exercising legislative power through the initiative process on the other. Finally, he mentioned the industrialization of the initiative process. Well, I can guarantee to you it wasn't the proponents of the initiative process that caused the industrialization of the initiative process. It was the opponents. It was the avalanche of often irrational and incomprehensible rules adopted by the Secretary of State, plus the bills enacted by this legislature over the last decade that have industrialized the initiative process. If you are pointing at the users of the initiative process and saying it's industrialized, you're blaming the victims. They didn't cause that to happen. They opposed that from they opposed all of the measures that have caused that to happen over the past decade. There's so much more to say, but perhaps we'll have additional hearing or additional time to do that in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Richard Boteri. I'm a registered voter, and I live in Portland. Mary Nolan is my representative.
Welcome.
And I have come here today not representing anybody other than my own opinion. And by way of background, I have known Mr. Meek for several years because we would get involved from time to time in election law issues when I was practicing law. He is a very fine lawyer, and his analysis of H.J.R. 17 is terrific and right on, and I can say that because he agrees with me. So I'm not here to blow anybody's horn. I will say by way of full disclosure that I oppose the initiative system both theoretically and practically, but I know that's not on the agenda today. So actually what I'm going to testify to actually is in support of initiative gatherers, signature gatherers, rather than and proponents of initiatives rather than the other way around. And H.J.R. 17, well, let me, some may know this, but others may not. I practiced election law as a sidelight to my litigation practice for 25 years, and I represented the Democratic caucuses in this legislature. I represented Oregon Democratic governors and congresspeople, and I was involved in many ballot measure campaigns. I wrote ballot measures. I opposed ballot measures. I fought through ballot title challenges. I fought through how you count signatures. I fought through how you determine whether signatures are forged or not forged. So I have a lot of interest in this area. Based on the experience that I have, I think that H.J.R. 17, unless it is substantially amended, just basically is not going to work as it's intended. The point that Mr. Meek raised about the two-year delay arises from the fact that paragraph 1, section 1E, provides that the initiative petition, after it has all of its signatures, shall be filed not less than 45 days before the first day of a regular session. So if one wanted to get the initiative, you pass this law now, wanted to get the initiative on the ballot, I think many of you understand, if the legislature begins in January, say January 2011, the signatures must be in by November 15th, more or less, 2010. But then, under the present system, you file your signatures, you get qualified, as Mr. Meek has said, and in 4 months there's the election. But here, there is a delay while the legislature looks at it throughout the 2011 session. But then at the end, after that language, Section 15C requires the Secretary of State to put it on the ballot at, quote, the next regular general election, close quote, after the legislative session in which it is considered. The next general election after the 2011 session is November 2012. And that's why it stretches it out for 2 years. I think, as Dan has said, and another gentleman said, I think that what this does is substantially reduce the ability of people to get their measures on the ballot, because you may have an issue which is important today, maybe popular, maybe of concern today. years after people signed the petition, people are not going to remember what they had signed. They're going to wonder why that's on the ballot. And it makes it very hard for people to take advantage of the concern the public may have at one time by having them not vote on the subject until 2 years later. I think that a lot of people will just not bother with petitions because it's going to take so long after they've gotten the signatures to get on the ballot. And so I think, even though I don't like the initiative generally, I think this is, I don't think anybody has any bad intentions here, but if you pass this law as it now stands, you will be effectively quashing much of the petition activity here in the state of Oregon, because I think people just won't be able to deal with this kind of confusion. And I think rather than being disingenuous, if the legislature wants to get rid of the initiative, it should get rid of the initiative and can submit a constitutional amendment. And I disagree with those who say that amendment would not pass. But that's the two-year problem, and I think that's a big problem. There's a second problem with this measure, and Dan has also quite brilliantly pointed out the same conclusion I had reached, and that is the legislature right now can do all this stuff that HJR 17 provides to the legislature. The difference is that it requires the legislature to look at all these measures during a regular session, which means that there are several controversial issues in the petitions. The legislature is going to have to devote time to those arguments and those battles in the legislature at a point in which the legislature can't do anything about the petitions. If the petitions are badly worded, if the petitions are illegal or unconstitutional, the legislature is going to look at this thing, can't do anything about it. And I do not like the idea of putting an alternative on the ballot. I think the anti-Mannix fix that happened last time was a bad piece of government. And I think we got a bad law in anyway. But I would say that what the legislature ought to do is that it first, it ought to perform the most important function, and that is looking at this bill to see whether it's ambiguous, whether it contravenes other state laws, whether it leaves out reference to other state activities that are important to consider if you put this thing into effect. In other words, the legislature could do what they normally do with any bill, is look at it to see how it fits with the rest of the session. And I would say the legislature should be allowed to modify this measure, keeping the intent of the petitioners, but changing the ambiguous parts of it or parts which don't work with other statutes, that sort of thing. Or I think the legislature can say to the people, we like this plan or we don't like this plan, vote yes or vote no. And that ought to be the end of it. I don't think that the rest of this information, trying to draft new laws and everything else, is really worthwhile, because the old law and the new law are going to be on the ballot anyway. And what you may end up doing in this process, if you have 2 years, is that the legislature may put a bill on, which really is unnecessary, because the other bill will probably not pass simply because of the two-year extension of time. As to the other measures that are on the ballot, the one that I like very much, what measures are on the ballot, is the other proposals which are before the committee. One I like very much is taking the ballot title writing out of the hands of the Attorney General and out of the hands of the court. The Attorney General, I think, has an inherent conflict of interest. He writes a ballot title, then he has to defend the state defending his own ballot title. The panel of judges does not have sufficient judicial review, so I don't think that would work as it now stands.
Questions for either of these? Thank you both for coming in for your testimony. And
one quick question.
Yes.
Mr. Meek, you talked about the delay and cited 1912. Do you remember that it actually had taken quite some time for that amendment to succeed? It had failed a couple of times.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks. We're going to close our hearing on HJR 17, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2895. And as you can tell, we're moving, but not as quickly as we would like. So we'll see how far we get today, and others may get carried over. So with that, we'll have a short explanation, and we can have Representative Cannon, Senator Whitsitt, come on up and be ready when we get ready to go.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2845 directs the Secretary of State to add to the caption of the ballot title for certain state initiative measures a phrase regarding the fiscal impact designated by the Financial Estimate Committee. It requires the Financial Estimate Committee to submit to the Secretary of State one of five specific phrases set forth in HB 2845 that most accurately reflects the fiscal impact of the measure. Directs the Secretary of State to add the submitted phrase as part of the caption to the ballot title in the voter's pamphlet and on the ballot. It exempts the phrase from the 15-word caption limitation and makes conforming changes to existing statutory procedures for preparing and filing fiscal estimates and for challenging whether those procedures were followed.
You wrote 2845. We're on 95.
Sorry about that. All right. Do you want to come back?
All right. It's not your bill.
My apologies. All right.
Had to get your attention.
We'll get right. House Bill 2895 permits the Secretary of State to designate one or more organizations to establish citizen panels to review and create statements of not less than 150 words on each initiated state measure. Requires the Secretary to print those statements in the voter's pamphlet, establishes eligibility criteria for organizations to be designated to review and create statements on initiated state measures, requires designated organizations to ensure the selection of panel members from a representative sample of anonymous electors using survey sampling methods to give each elector a similar chance of being selected, requires designated organizations to the extent practical and legally permissible to ensure that demographic makeup of each citizen panel fairly reflects the population of the state with regard to age, education, and geographic location, declares an emergency effective on passage.
And with that, thank you both for being here. And Senator Whitsett.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Doug Whitsett. I represent District 28 in Oregon Senate. I'll be brief. I'm a strong advocate of the voter initiative. I believe that our government belongs to the people and that the people have every right to develop their own laws. In my opinion, House Bill 2895 strengthens that direct lawmaking authority of the people. Too often, we are deluged by partisan rhetoric during initiatives during the election season. This bill will provide an alternative to that partisan rancor. It is designed to provide a fair and balanced analysis of each initiative. The analysis is to be developed by a panel of voters carefully selected for impartiality. The panel will then develop a position statement through research, public hearings, and work sessions similar to the legislative process. It is designed to provide the voters with an objective, impartial, nonpartisan analysis of each initiative to be printed in the voter's pamphlet. I believe that the pilot citizens review panel worked effectively to produce the nonpartisan analysis that was desired. For that reason, I am convinced that we should continue to develop this citizens' review procedure. Please support House Bill 2895.
Thank you. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Ben Cannon, State Representative, House District 46. I believe this is the first time I have co-testified with Senator Whitsett. I hope that it is not the last. I see this bill as an attempt to respond to the frustration that I've heard from many voters about the challenge of making informed and deliberate choices on very complex and often lengthy ballot measures. I think the majority of Oregon voters recognize that the issues they're asked to vote on are complex, that those issues do not lend themselves to black and white answers, not always very well to up or down yes or no votes. And they wonder, I think, the kinds of questions they wonder about are where they can get unbiased information about consequences and trade-offs and who can be trusted. This bill would provide voters with an additional tool, this citizens panel, to help them make informed decisions on the complex choices they face. I want to point out that some of the other bills, resolutions you're considering today are, I think, very much in the same vein, and I particularly point out HJRs 17, 23, and 28. But this is a really interesting and, I think, creative idea. Democracy is a wonderful experiment, and it's one that we're continuing to test and improve. And one of the things that I think we've learned over our experience from history with democracy is that successful democracies are ones that build deliberation into the system. That's why our founders chose a Republican, small r, form of government. That's why we care about trying to ensure that voters are well-informed. That's why the legislature operates the way it does, with its multiple chambers and committees and requirements for revenue and fiscal impact statements and public notice and the like. This particular issue does raise, I think, challenging philosophical question that I haven't fully worked out in my own mind, but I ask you to deliberate on, regarding whether it's appropriate or the degree to which it's appropriate for government to privilege a particular effort to provide voters with information and opinion on a ballot measure. But as you do that deliberation, I'd ask you to consider a couple of things. One is whether the process that the bill sponsors here envision is itself content neutral, whether it sets up a process that is content neutral, neutral as to the ballot measure under consideration. And second, I'd ask you to try to think about what kind of analogs there may be for government creating these kinds of settings or forums for deliberation and information added to the process. For example, the explanatory statement that is already in the voter's pamphlet appears to be a precedent for this kind of work. Likewise, state government-sponsored forums, to the extent that they exist, and they may not, but you might ask, is it appropriate for state government to be in the business of creating a forum that might even include a straw poll for participants on a ballot measure? This is, a creative and, I think, responsive attempt to address what I understand to believe and believe to be a real need among Oregonians for the kind of information that I think this would provide. Encourage the measure to you, and look forward to conversations about it.
Question? Representative Burr. Yes, go first.
Okay. Gentlemen, wasn't there a similar review last fall of a ballot through a citizen review process?
Yes, there was, and I reviewed that rather closely. And I thought that the result of it was pretty much impartial. It was well done, and that was my primary reason for support of this bill. I liked the process, and I'm particularly outcome oriented, and I liked the outcome.
Representative Perker, follow up.
Yes, my question then is this. If you establish this process and it were paid for by the state, because someone would have to at least per diem people to come and meet and talk, don't you think the perception would be the state paid for it, therefore it's the state's answer? Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, I don't like to point out the jaded nature of our electorate, but the reality is that if this were a state paid for a state driven process, it would be seen pretty much as the state getting to the answer they want.
Actually, Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, as you know, the states pay for the courts as well.
That is true. That is true. Thank you for that.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is one of those philosophical questions. Do you think there is any such thing as an objective person on issues that are contentious enough that they rise to the level that people are passionate enough to gather signatures to put on an initiative petition?
Chair Roblin, Representative Gelser, I think certainly I know that we could not among us agree on who that single objective person is. I know that much. I do think that the efforts that this endeavor makes to find a group of people that is broadly representative of the Oregon public with all their subjectivity would attempt to approximate a process that could result in a balanced view of the matter, and certainly a more well-reasoned and in-depth view of the matter than the typical voter gets from the sort of series of favorable and opposing measure statements in the voter's pamphlet.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? Can I follow up?
Yes, please do.
Thank you. It seems all of these are so interesting because it seems like in our effort to tame the initiative process, which is so core to who we are as Oregonians and really as Westerners, what we're trying to do is inject it with a sense of legislative deliberation. And I think what's different about this one, the other measures have us bring it back into the legislative body for that deliberation. This puts it back in the hands of citizens. But I don't think any of us come here and I would not pretend to suggest that I'm objective on anything that we hear here. I try to listen to things with an open mind, but certainly the citizens in my district and in yours have sent you because the majority of them agree with the majority of the positions that you take on issues. Why is this approach better than the others, which would bring it back to the legislature where the citizens have determined who that, not necessarily non-objective, but what that deliberative body is going to be? Does that question make sense?
Yes, sir.
Chair Roblin, Representative Gelser, the initiative process is, in my mind, is a response usually on the part of the citizens to something that the legislature has done or has not done that has not been popular with the citizens. And I think that it's appropriate that we have a citizen review to get some impartial, and I say impartial, and I don't believe that any member of a group selected like that necessarily would be impartial, but we would hope that as the legislature does, if it's properly run, the results should be reasonably impartial. If you hear all sides of the issue, then you should be able to come, whether you come to a conclusion, at least you should be able to discuss intelligently all the different aspects of that question. And I think that putting it back to the legislature puts it back, you know, the analogy is the fox in the hen house, so to speak, whereas with the Citizen Review Board, it is as impartial a group as can be put together, as carefully as it can be put together, to carefully analyze an initiative and provide as near as possible an impartial opinion to the public as what this bill, this would or would not do.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I don't think, as I mentioned in my testimony, I'm enthusiastic about several of the other resolutions that you're considering today, so I wouldn't say that this is preferable necessarily. I think it's really in the same vein, and it's that vein that emphasizes the idea that deliberation yields better outcomes, and that's true about the legislature. It would be true about a citizens' review panel as well, and that's a sort of fundamental tenet of my own faith. I've only been down here a session and a half, and maybe I'll be disabused of it by the time I'm done with this or later sessions. But I have it now, and I think this is very much in that vein.
Thank you very much.
Any others? Thank you both.
Thank you.
And since we're getting close to our time of five, we're going to try to limit people to about 2 minutes a person, considering the number we have here on this bill. And then, if I have a few minutes left, if there are people who don't think they can make it here the next Wednesday, I will probably open up some others so that those people who could not be here could get some testimony in, with the expectation that others will be able to come back on Friday. Wednesday? Wednesday. And maybe Friday, seeing how many bills we have to do. So, with that, Tyrone Rittman, Elliot Shufford, Kathy Defense from Clackamas County.
Did they have some? They have a couple of people that are not sure if they want to report them, but I guess they have their
own. Okay.
There's another person.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Chair Roble, members of the committee, my name is Tyrone Reitman. I'm from Eugene, Oregon. So 2 minutes, I will do my best. Just a couple of quick things about HB 2895. The first is the review is really designed to accomplish two goals, and that's first, clearly, to provide better information to voters on what they're currently receiving, and second, to significantly increase accountability on our initiative process. And we're looking at the subject of initiative reform in general. I thought there were a couple of facts to bring up that are important to keep in mind. The first is that clearly these are high-cost campaigns we're talking about. Since 2000 alone, over $100 million has been spent to sway the vote one way or the other. Second, these are obviously high-stakes campaigns as well. We're talking about $50 billion worth of decisions being made at the ballot since the year 2000, to say nothing of the numerous significant social policies that have been on the ballot as well. And third, just to point out that the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that contributions to and expenditures by initiative campaigns cannot be regulated, nor can the right of pay petition circulators being curtailed. So this limits the overall scope of what can be done in reforming the initiative process.
So given these facts,
what do we know about the public's view of our initiative process? We actually know quite a bit, and in your briefing documents, provided a document called Key Public Opinion Findings. It's printed in Peach. And I've summarized polls over the last 6 or so years. So first, I think it's safe to say the public is generally satisfied with the initiative process overall, and this is demonstrated repeatedly. At the same time, a majority of the public agrees that there are some problems with how the initiative process is currently working. So there's satisfaction that we have an initiative process and a recognition that there are problems with it as well. Second, voters consistently report using the voter's pamphlet when voting on ballot measures, and it's clear the voter's pamphlet is used. And that said, the voter's pamphlet appears to impact voting behavior when it comes to ballot measures, with most voters reporting that reading the voter's pamphlet influences how they vote. Third, a supermajority of voters report voting on measures that they are still unfamiliar with, and this is a key point. The voters vote when they're unfamiliar with ballot measures. And in addition to that, 75% of voters report the measures are often too complicated and too confusing to know what will happen if passed.
That has been about 2 minutes, so if you can just quick, I'll
go real quick. Got more points? Okay. And lastly, as far as public opinion is concerned, voters would prefer by a wide margin a report from a balanced panel of voters than from the legislature, and the voter's pamphlet as an additional source of information, and widely support the Citizens Initiative Review based on polling, focus groups, and 30,000 voters having signed on to the proposal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elliot Schubert. I live in Portland. Thank you for holding a hearing on 2895. A couple things I want to point out very quickly about 2895. It's not meant to be unbiased. It is meant to bring together a group of randomly selected citizens with all of their views and that diversity from around the state, bring them together in a setting in which they can have a fair and open hearing about ballot measures. So they're not supposed to be necessarily unbiased. We want a diversity of views. When we've discussed the Citizens Initiative Review with legislators over the last several years, two questions usually come up. First one is, can it be done? Can you pull together a group of randomly selected registered voters, and can they deliberate together meaningfully and come up with a good conclusion? When we addressed this committee as well as Senate Rules Committee in 2008, we felt confident that our answer was yes. And we were pleased to report to the committee that we would be running a demonstration of the Citizens Initiative Review in September of that same year. I can sit here and say that the demonstration of the process was a great success. We held we followed our proposed methodology for a high-quality 5-day hearing, bringing together randomly selected voters from across the state. They heard from both the advocates for and against the measure as they called on background witnesses that they wanted to hear from to hear more specific answers to their questions. They deliberated in a variety of formats, and at the end of the process, they came up with a 1-page statement. Now, to the second question, which is really this question of the high cost of information for voters that Representative Smith referred to in his testimony to this committee on Friday. The idea with the Citizens Initiative Review and House Bill 2895 is to reduce that cost of information and provide some information for people to support their personal deliberations. We believe it'll have that impact. I believe Tyrone referred to some statistics that support that viewpoint. Now we're back before the committee asking you to consider legislation which will enable our next step, a larger scale pilot project. Is that 2 minutes? Okay, I'm going to go quick. It's the next pilot project, and it essentially spells out criteria for an organization to do the citizen reviews per our methodology and puts the statement in the voter's pamphlet in the place that we intend for it to be. I want to just quickly, in closing, cutting down to the end, that if we can take a step back and think about if Oregon did have a high-quality review process such as what we're describing, and if it was trusted and used by individuals in their public deliberation, would this not serve the public interest and Oregon's democracy in its highest form? So I urge you to schedule a work session for House Bill 2895 and move this bill to the rest of the body. So thank you.
Thank you. And you're doing very well. I have to. Could you move the mic
Chair
over?
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Fonts, and I am a farmer in Clackamas County. I was one of the lucky people to be on that panel. And I've lived in Oregon most of my life, and the initiative process has been a part of that. And I've long been frustrated by the polarizing campaigns, the smear tactics, the high-profile emotional presentations, but the lack of facts regarding initiatives. When people run for office, they can have town halls, they can have Q&As. We can have the opportunity to ask questions and clarify things. But when it comes to ballot initiatives, that's missing. And the opportunity to ask questions, in-depth questions, was liberating, was edifying, and Representative Gelser was talking about, is anybody ever impartial? Well, I can tell you that there were people who brought opinions to that group that after hearing in-depth testimony and being able to ask in-depth questions changed their minds. So, yes, it is possible if you have access to information to make an informed decision. And I would support the opportunities for citizens to do this and for the information that they're able to glean from the questions that come from their heart with the rest of people in Oregon to make informed decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. You could, see, she made up for some of your time.
I sure did.
Thank you very much. No, it was very good. Questions, yes.
Question, Ms. Fonts?
Yes.
How do we expand that experience to the 1.5 million people who actually cast ballots?
You know, I thought about that. I thought about this a lot. And one of the things that I think would be important would be public access to the proceedings. And the fact that if there were these citizens' panels, it would be almost like a jury selection, and there would have to be credibility based on the fact that people are randomly selected and people do come back to their communities and share their experiences. So there it's two-pronged. One would be, I came home and I told everybody I knew about this incredible experience. But two, if there could be public access to the proceedings so that they could see the questions that were asked and how they were answered, then they, in essence, would have been in that room.
Thank you. Other questions? Yeah, follow-up?
If we could get them to pay attention.
Yes, that's true. But as Elliot pointed out, it would also be, and most importantly, be in the voter's pamphlet. And when it comes down to the 11th hour, people are sitting there with that pamphlet, and they're making their decisions. I would look for impartial findings over special interest groups in making my decisions.
Thank you all for being here. I don't see any other questions. So next we will have Frank Oliver, Jenny Lillage, Cappy Eaton. And for the record, I have one other person that's still later to call, and that's Dan Meek. Is there anyone else that didn't get on this list? Okay, that's good. And then I will, if there's people who can't come back next time, I'll talk to you about getting some testimony. So proceed. Thank you. Let me go with Frank.
Representative Roblin, Frank Oliver, Redmond, Oregon, and I, too, was a panelist last September. Excuse me if I can keep my voice going. And it was most interesting and most educational to me. I have just a few words to say. Certainly, we strive to be in a learning mode. At least I do when I go to vote. And we support a fair process. We treat each other and each other's opinions with respect. We all had a voice. We all did our best and assumed that others were doing theirs, and we certainly shared responsibility for the success of the process. And just a few other words. These were things that we did during the opportunity we had last September. Listen with care, and that we did. Maintain focus, indeed. Maintain a positive attitude, and a positive attitude was maintained by all 24 panelists. Practice brevity and clarity. And it was done. It was good. In all my 72 years, not all of which I was old enough to worry about voting, but I just cannot emphasize enough how important this particular program could be if maintained and brought about and maintained effectively. Participate fully, and we did. 5 days of participating fully. I was tired at the end of 5 days, but it was worth it. And disagree positively. And we did have disagreements. But, you know, we kept our fists to ourselves, if you will. Not that it ever came to something like that. But we definitely had a very good taste in our mouths at the end of the session. And that, I think, concludes what I have to say regarding the project.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Lilge, and I'm a resident of Salem, Oregon, in Representative Berger's district. Good afternoon. I also was able to participate on the demonstration panel with Frank and Kathy, who you've heard from. And something I wanted to touch on something Senator Whitsitt said when he talked about how the campaign season is full of partisan rhetoric. And that's to be expected, and you on the committee show that there are good ideas from both sides of the spectrum. But I'm more concerned with the special interests and the advertisement that goes along with that. And just some examples are the use of Dorothy English in the Prop 37 campaign, and also in this past election with the idea of something being bad for firefighters or bad for nurses and teachers. And these flashy TV ads have been controlling the way these initiatives have gone. And so it was just such a wonderful opportunity to be able to sit for 5 days and hear testimony and ask questions from both sides of the issue. We got to hear from Bill Sizemore, who has become quite a legend in this state for his work on initiatives. And, you know, love him or hate him, we have a very different perspective on him because we actually got to hear him talk to us, which, you know, it's just something that's important on in terms of looking at, you know, what these initiatives are about. So I really valued the opportunity to be able to find out more information about the initiative that we were reviewing and to be able to ask questions. And at the end, as Kathy said, you know, we had the information and we had facts about what this initiative actually meant. And then it was pretty humorous then a few weeks later when we got to start seeing the advertisements on TV and realize how different they were than what this actual initiative was about. So that's why I support House Bill 2895 to allow for more of these citizen initiative review panels.
Thank you very much. Kathy.
Members of the committee, Chair Rowland, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton, Governance Chair for the League of Women Voters, and we're all about citizen knowledge and understanding of the initiative proposals. We believe they're important both to the integrity of the initiative process and to the enactment of Oregon laws. We believe that this process that's put forward in 2895 merits consideration both for the opportunity that it promotes, but also the opportunity for public-private partnership, which is what it would do. The League was asked to follow the process from the inception to the final evaluation. We participated in the steps leading to the panel selection, and an attorney member was present during the entire 5 days of the process. Our assessment was positive as to the value of the discussion of the initiative, and we made constructive recommendations for the future use of the process. The proposal on HB 2895 simply allows the Secretary of State to designate organizations who would work collectively to establish citizen panels for the purpose of reviewing state initiatives. Any of you heard the positive reports about the ability to do that? And then the statement would be published in the voter's pamphlet, which is an important result of one of the goals of that process. We strongly support this idea in the interest of voter education. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks to all of you for being here. Thanks for being on the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Questions?
I probably should have asked this of the first panel, but since we have two members of the panel, I've heard the people who've participated directly talk about the opportunity that they've had to get better information and a better understanding. Do you have any evidence that this has actually translated into a better informed electorate as a whole? Did we do any testing of the electorate to see if any of them remember reading the statement or remember learning, you know, having a different opinion about it? And as I said, maybe someone else
right.
who has already.
This might be a better question for Tyrone or.
Yeah.
Sure, come on up if you have an answer to that question.
If it pleases the chair, could I say a few
sure.
words? After I got home from the program that I attended, I made it. I talked to friends, neighbors, so on, about the wonderful program that it was. That when I picked up the voter's pamphlet and saw so much that really I couldn't have cared less about, and yet when I described how we arrived at the problems or what could have been problems, etc., it was positively received by the people who were listening, and so from that standpoint, I think it's, if I don't downright know, that it is something that probably this state could use and use better.
So any answer to the question with regards to statistics?
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, the question of impact is the point of House Bill 2895. We want to test this once it goes out in the voter's pamphlet. Unfortunately, we had a reference in the argument section to the citizen statement that we did for this demonstration project. It was there was a complaint registered with the Secretary of State's office that it was not argumentative enough to be in the argument section. So it was not published. So there was not. So we did not do an evaluation of that because we assumed that there would not be a significant impact on the electorate. The point of 2895, again, is to put the citizen statement in place. We have an evaluation committee made up of university professors in public policy and political science from across the state, several state universities. The evaluation methodology is being developed currently, and we have money set aside for an evaluation of this process should we pass House Bill 2895.
And to add one thing to that, and Tyrone Ryman again, there's also a memo in the packet of information we provided from the evaluation committee on the methodology and where we are at that. So thank you.
Thanks
very much for that. And our last two on this, Dan Meek and Richard Butteri.
I just have one very, very brief comment,
okay.
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
In listening to this testimony about this Citizens Review Commission, I think it's needed, and I recalled an incident that happened back in the 1960s, which was perhaps the most notorious and the most brilliant advertising campaign against an initiative. There was a gentleman in Portland by the name of Ed Rinke, I think is what his name was. And he was the guy you went to if you wanted to defeat an initiative. And a ballot measure known as Ballot Measure 6 was going to be on the ballot, and the opponents came to him to have him create a campaign. He couldn't think of anything that was wrong with Ballot Measure 6. So his campaign was simply to plaster the state of Oregon with billboards, big red billboards, which I still remember seeing, which simply said, what are the tricks in 6? Measure 6 went down to defeat.
Right. Mr. Meek.
God.
Dan Meek again. I do have written testimony. Unfortunately, although I corrected it this morning to refer to the correct bill number, 2895, I then copied the wrong version and distributed that to you. So I would like opportunity to amend that.
Yes.
If this bill were to designate Healthy Democracy Oregon to run these citizen panels and provide state funding for it, I would say no problem, and I hope the bill would be so amended. But I see some problems with the existing version of it. First, it allows the Secretary of State to choose the organization to run the citizen panels and do the selection with no criteria applying to the selection of the organization itself. The future Secretary of State, for example, might pick Oregonians in Action to run the citizen panel on a land use measure or pick other organizations that do have a vested interest, and there's no criteria that says the organization isn't supposed to have a vested interest. I would suggest and do suggest in my testimony maybe a panel of university presidents would pick the organizations to run the panels, or that there at least be criteria like it would be an organization that receives no funding from corporations or unions or other politically involved entities. Second, because there's no state funding in this bill, it encourages the selection of only well-funded organizations to run the panels. I'm told that running the panels costs $50,000 to $70,000. So the average citizen group isn't going to be able to do that. You need money in order to be able to do it. That may cause reliance on special interests to provide the money in order to do it. So I think the lack of state funding is a problem. Third, it allows the selected organization to bias the outcome by selecting the moderator of the panel. Again, no criteria for selecting the moderator, no opportunity for the pro and con sides to object to the moderator. As you know, it seems to me that the citizen panel operates something like a grand jury, and you know the saying that a prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. I've seen lots of focus groups in which the moderator does influence the outcome of the focus group unintentionally, simply because of the moderator's bias, which can come from two sources. One, the moderator can be a subject matter expert who probably does have a bias, and that is conveyed to the group, even though that's not desired. Or second, the moderator is not a subject matter expert at all, in which case the moderator has to be briefed on the subject matter in order to moderate the group, and then is heavily influenced by the information that's provided in the briefing. Who provides the briefing to the moderator? So I would say that it would be improved if both the proponents and the opponents were allowed to have approval authority over the moderator. And that gets into the question, who are the opponents of the measure? The proponents are pretty well defined, maybe the chief petitioners, but there may be a variety of groups or individuals who oppose a measure for different reasons. And this is a problem already when it comes to designating the opponents in explanatory committee statements. Or explanatory statement committees. In any event, let's amend the bill to just say Healthy Democracy Oregon will do this and provide some state funding, and I'd say that's a great plan to mend it, not end it.
Okay. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you both, and we will close our public hearing on House Bill 2895. Now, is there anyone here who came from a distance and can't come back on Monday because we're going to carry the other bills over? If there are people, I'm sorry, I keep doing that. Today, Tuesday. Let's go to Wednesday. Is there anyone that can't?
Well, my question was, is it Monday or Wednesday?
It's Wednesday.
I don't think that I can.
Come on up and we'll open a hearing. We'll take your testimony.
Okay, well.
Which bill was it that you came to testify on?
House. It's a good question. After listening to that, House Bill 3431.
House Bill 3431. We have that.
Yes.
So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3431. 3431.
For the record, my name is Jim Ludwig. I live at 7500 Southwest Liebold Road in McMinnville. I'm in favor of House Bill 3431. This last year, I worked on an initiative. A citizen-derived initiative, and I've done that over many times over the past 30 years, and I'm sure some of you have done similar things, and you've stood out in the rain and the cold and tried to collect signatures, and you've seen the problem that you've had trying to get people to sign their name coherently. I mean, I can recall this last time standing outside of the post office and trying to have people sign the petition sheet on a on a board, and they're trying to juggle their mail and everything else. And it just seems to me that it's difficult enough process to get people to sign in a manner that they would always be recognized when it goes to the Secretary of State's office or the county clerk's office. I think this body should do everything it possibly can to help citizen-derived initiatives go forward in the process and not put impediments into it. Having said that, I've watched the ability of citizen-derived initiatives plummet over the 30-plus years I've lived in this state. Folks are continually putting more obstacles, not only into having signatures verified, but just in the ability to go someplace and collect them. We used to be able to go inside of a Fred Meyer's and be able to do it. You can't do that anymore. I encourage you to pass this bill. If somebody signed a petition and it's unclear, I can tell you I've had people sign who've taken three lines to sign because their handwriting is so scraggly. I've had people who are, I assume, are legally blind and had their companion sign for them and made a note to that. Let's, you know, this is citizens asking to be heard, and I encourage you to do everything you possibly can to allow people who've signed petitions to get credit for those petitions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this witness? I appreciate you for coming, and thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing on 3431. So we are going to carry over. I'll say Wednesday now. And so which ones? We're going to carry over 3431, 2942, HGR 23, House Bill 2845, House Bill 2820, and HGR 28. Thank you. Is there any other questions to come before our committee?
Nope.
Seeing none, we're going to close the Committee on Rules. Thank you all for being here.